Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you very much, Simon. It's a great pleasure to be here at this AmCham event. It's also great to be here in Perth. Normally, when I'm in Perth, it's bright and sunny. So it's a bit of a shock to see the weather today. I hope it's not an omen for the economic climate. I don't think it is. This lunch is being held at a time when one chapter in Australia's economic history is drawing to a close and another chapter is about to start. A main theme of the chapter that's coming to an end is the mining investment boom. That boom and its unwinding has been central to the story of the Australian and the Western Australian economies for more than a decade now. The new chapter will almost certainly have a different theme. Now, today I'd like to provide a sketch of some of the likely plot lines of this next chapter. Before doing that, though, I'd like to reflect on the current chapter. The storyline of the current chapter is well known to you all. It's had two main plot lines. The first was a troubled global economy. A decade ago, we had the financial crisis and the worst recession in the advanced economies since the 1930s. A gradual recovery then took place, but it was painfully slow. Recently, things have improved noticeably, and unemployment rates in some of the advanced economies are now at the lowest level in many decades. Throughout this chapter, central banks have mostly worried that inflation rates might turn out to be too low, not too high, as traditionally would have been the case. Interest rates have also been at record lows, and workers in advanced economies have experienced low growth in their nominal wages. So overall, it's been a challenging international backdrop. The second plot line was the resources boom. Strong growth in China saw strong growth in demand for our resources. Prices rose in response, and you can see here that Australia's terms of trade reached their highest levels in at least 150 years. You have to go back to the gold rushes of the 1850s. Then an investment boom took place in response to higher prices, with investment in the resources sector reaching its highest share of GDP in more than a century. And we're now seeing the dividends of all this, with large increases taking place in Australia's resource exports. Overall, it's been a reasonably successful chapter in our economic history. Real income per person is around 20% higher than it was in the mid-2000s, and real wealth per person is 40% higher. Australia is one of the few advanced economies that avoided a recession in 2008-2009, and the biggest mining investment boom in a century did not end in a crash, as previous booms did. Our interest rates have remained in positive territory, unlike those in most other advanced economies. And since the mid-2000s, the unemployment rate in Australia has averaged 5.25%, a better outcome than the previous three decades. Inflation has averaged 2.5%, the midpoint of the Reserve Bank's target range. And over this period, GDP growth has averaged 2.75%, higher than in almost all other advanced economies. So taking this period as a whole, it's a positive picture. At the same time, though, as the current chapter draws to a close, we do face some issues, and I'd like to briefly highlight three of those. The first is the recent slow growth in real per capita income in Australia. For much of the past two decades, real national income per person grew very strongly here, and you can see that in this chart. We benefited from strong productivity growth, higher commodity prices, and more of the population working. As you can see, in contrast, since 2011, there has been little net growth in real per capita incomes. And this change in trend is proving a difficult adjustment for our community. The solutions are strong productivity growth and increased labour force participation. A second issue is the unusually slow growth in nominal and real wages. Over the past 4 years, the increase in average hourly earnings has been the slowest since at least the mid-1960s. And you can see that here. The slow growth is partly a consequence of the unwinding of the mining investment boom, but there are structural factors at work as well. And it's putting a strain on household budgets, and it's also contributing to low rates of inflation. A third issue is the high level of household debt and housing prices. Over recent times, Australians have borrowed a lot to purchase housing. And this has added to the upward pressure on housing prices, especially in our two largest cities, where structural factors are also at work. Australians are coping reasonably well with the higher level of debt, but as debt levels have increased relative to our incomes, so too have the medium-term risks that we face. The very high level of housing prices in our largest cities is also making it difficult for those on low and middle incomes to buy their own home. So as we turn the final pages of this chapter, these are some of the issues that we face. But as we turn these final pages, we also see an improvement in a number of fronts. Business conditions, as reported in surveys, are at the highest level in almost 10 years. There are growing signs that private business investment outside the resources sector is picking up, and you can see that in this chart. We've been waiting for this pickup for many years. For a number of years, animal spirits seem to have been missing, and many firms preferred to put off making decisions to undertake capital spending. It does appear now that some of this reluctance to invest is now passing. According to the June quarter national accounts, private non-mining business investment increased strongly over the first half of 2017, and it's up around 10% since the start of 2016. There's also been an increase in non-residential building approvals, and there is a large pipeline of public infrastructure investment to be completed, as you can see in the bottom panel of this chart. The decline in mining investment has also largely run its course. There's also been positive news on the employment front in recent times. Over the past year, the number of people with jobs in Australia has increased by more than 2.5%. That's a positive outcome given that the working age population is increasing at a rate of around 1.5% a year. There's been particularly strong growth in full-time employment, which is good news, and the various forward-looking indicators suggest that labour market conditions will remain positive in the period immediately ahead. Here in Western Australia, there are also some signs of improvement after what has been a difficult few years. The drag from mining investment is diminishing, and as you can see from the bottom left panel of this chart, businesses are feeling more positive than they were a year ago, and employment has been rising after a period of decline. At the same time, though, conditions in the housing market here in Perth remain very difficult, with housing prices and rents continuing to fall. Weak residential construction has been weighing on aggregate demand over this year, although the building approvals data and our liaison with business here in Perth suggest that some stabilisation could take place in the period immediately ahead. For Australia as a whole, the recent national accounts, which showed a healthy increase in output of 0.8% of GDP in the June quarter, were in line with our expectations. These and other recent data are consistent with the Reserve Bank's central scenario for GDP growth averaging around the 3% mark over the next couple of years. This is a bit faster than our current estimate of potential growth in the Australian economy, so we'd expect to see a gradual decline in the unemployment rate. And this should lead to some pickup in wages growth, although we expect this to be a very gradual process given the structural factors at work that I've spoken about on previous occasions. And we can also expect to see a gradual increase in inflation back towards the middle of the 2 to 3% medium-term target range. There are clearly risks around this central scenario. We would like to see the improvement in business investment consolidate and a continuation of jobs growth at a rate at least sufficient to absorb the increase in Australia's workforce. Some pickup in wage growth in response to a tighter labour market would also be a welcome development. So these are some of the areas we're watching. But as things stand, the economy does look to be picking up. I'd now like to lift my gaze a little and turn to the next chapter in our economic story. And I want to sketch out four of the possible plot lines, including some of the stories that we'd like to read about over the next chapter of our economic history. A first likely plot line, as it has been in previous chapters, is the ongoing shift in the global economy. Here, changes in technology and further growth in Asia are likely to be prominent themes. In some quarters, there is pessimism about future prospects for the global economy. The pessimists cite demographic trends, high debt levels, increasing regulatory burdens that stifle innovation, and political issues. They see a future of low productivity growth and only modest increases in average living standards. It's right to be concerned about the issues the pessimists focus on, but I am more optimistic about the ability of advances in technology to propel growth in the global economy, just as they've done in the past. We're still learning how to take advantage of recent advances in technology, including advances in the tools of science. In time, we will do this, and new industries and methods of production will evolve, some of which are even hard to even imagine today. So there's still plenty of upside. The challenge we face is to make sure that the benefits of advances in technology are widely shared, and how well we do this could have a major bearing on the next chapter in our economic history. Beyond this broad theme, it's appropriate to recognise the important leadership role that the United States plays in the global economy. If the US economy does well, so does most of the rest of the world. The United States has long been a supporter of open markets and a rules-based international system. It's also been the breeding ground for much of the progress in technology. It's been a safe place for people to invest and an important source of financial capital for other countries. It's in our interest that the US continues to play this important role, and a retreat from this would make all our lives more complicated. Another important influence on the next chapter is how things play out in China. While growth in China is trending lower, the share of global output produced in China will continue to rise as per capita incomes converge towards those in the more advanced economies, and you can see this convergence in this chart. As it takes place, the structure of the Chinese economy will change, and so too will China's economic relationship with Australia. Exports of resources will continue to be an important part of that relationship, and increasingly trade in services and other high-valued industries, including food, will become more important. Notwithstanding this, there are risks on the horizon, with the Chinese economy going through some difficult adjustments. One of these is the switch from a growth model based on industrial expansion to one more based on services. Another is managing an increasingly large and complex financial system. Australia has a strong interest in China successfully managing these transitions. Another shift in the global economy that could shape the next chapter is the growth of other economies in Asia. Developments in India and Indonesia bear especially close watching. In both these countries, especially India, they have very large populations and per capita incomes are still quite low, as you can see here. In time, the effects of economic progress in India and Indonesia and other countries in the region could be expected to have a substantial effect on the Australian economy, just as the development of China has in the last chapter of our economic history. A second likely plot line of the next chapter is a return to more normal monetary conditions globally. Since the financial crisis, we've been through an extraordinary period in monetary history. Interest rates have been very low and they've been negative in some countries. Central banks have greatly expanded their balance sheets in order to buy assets from the private sector. This is especially the case in Japan, as you can see in this chart. It's good news that this period of global monetary expansion is now drawing to a close. So some normalisation of monetary conditions globally should be seen as a positive development, although it does carry risks. It's a sign that economic growth in the advanced economies has become self-sustaining rather than being dependent just on monetary stimulus. It would also lift the return to many savers who've been receiving very low returns on interest-bearing assets for a decade now. On the other side of the ledger, though, periods of rising interest rates globally have historically exposed overborrowing somewhere in the global system. Investment strategies that look sensible when interest rates were very low tend not to look so good when interest rates are higher. I think we can take some comfort from the major efforts over the past decade to improve the resilience of the global financial system. but at the same time, investors have increasingly been prepared to take more risk in the search for yield. Many continue to expect a continuation of low rates of inflation and low interest rates, despite unemployment rates in many countries being very low. So this is an area that's worth watching. If higher interest rates are the result of a surprise increase in inflation, financial markets could be in for a period of difficult adjustment. A rise in global interest rates has no automatic implications for us here in Australia. Notwithstanding this, an increase in global interest rates would, over time, be expected to flow through to us, just as the lower interest rates over recent times have. Our flexible exchange rate, though, gives us a degree of independence regarding the timing as to when this might happen. And this brings me to the third plot line. That is how we deal with the higher level of household debt and higher housing prices, especially in a world of more normal interest rates. It's likely that higher levels of household debt have changed household spending patterns. Having increased their borrowing, households are less inclined to let consumption growth run ahead of income growth than they were in the past. Higher levels of debt also mean that household spending could be quite sensitive to increases in interest rates, something the Reserve Bank will be paying close attention to. To date, households have been coping reasonably well with the higher debt levels. The aggregate debt-to-income ratio has trended higher, but the ratio of interest payments to income is not particularly high, as you can see on the right-hand panel here, given the low level of interest rates. Housing loan arrears remain low, although they have increased a little recently, especially here in Western Australia. Over recent times, one issue the Reserve Bank has focused on is the build-up of medium-term risks from growth in household debt persistently outpacing growth in household income. Our concern has been that in this environment, a small shock could turn into a more serious correction as households seek to repair their balance sheets. We've been working with APRA and through the Council of Financial Regulators to address this risk. The various measures that APRA have taken are having a positive impact in improving the resilience of household balance sheets. And the fourth likely plot line is a broadening of the drivers of growth in the Australian economy. How the next chapter in our economic history turns out depends partly on our ability to lift productivity growth across a wide range of industries. The resources sector will no doubt continue to make an important contribution to the Australian economy, but it's unlikely that will shape the next chapter in our economic history as it did the current chapter. With another major upswing in Australia's terms of trade unlikely, and the working age share of the population having peaked as the population ages, improving productivity will be the key to growth in our national income. The drivers of growth are clearly changing. They increasingly depend on our ability to produce innovative goods and services in a rapidly changing world. In this world, it's difficult to make precise predictions about where the jobs and growth in the economy will come from in the future. But it seems clear that we'll be best placed to take advantage of whatever opportunities arise if businesses and our workforce are innovative and they're adaptable. Australia is fortunate to have a natural resource base that provides an important source of national income, and that's certainly going to remain the case. But in this next chapter, we will need to look more directly to the skills of our workers and our businesses to drive economic growth. If we're to take advantage of the opportunities that are offered by technology and growth in Asia, we need a flexible workforce with strong skills in the area of problem solving, critical thinking and communication. Investment in human capital will be one of the keys to success. We also need a competitive business environment that encourages innovation. And how well the next chapter turns out will depend on how well we do in these areas. So in summary, these are some of the themes that we might expect to see in the next chapter. The impact of technology and the growth of Asia, the normalisation of monetary conditions globally, the effects of higher levels of household debt, and the capability of our workforce and business to be flexible, innovative, and adaptable. It's obviously not a complete list. There are clearly other factors that could have a major influence on the storyline, including how geopolitical tensions are resolved and how we adjust to climate change, and no doubt there'll be plenty of surprises along the way as well. But overall, I remain optimistic about how this next chapter might unfold. While we have our challenges, some of which I've talked about, we also have some considerable advantages. We have a strong institutional policy framework, a skilled, growing and diverse population, and a wealth of mineral and agricultural resources. We have strong links to Asia, the fastest growing area of the world economy. We also have a flexible economy with a demonstrated capability to adjust to the changing world. And these factors should give us confidence about the future. But we can't rest on this, and there are a number of significant risks. The world is a competitive place, and the global economy is continuing to go through some challenging adjustments. If we are to do well in this world, we need to keep investing in both physical and human capital. We also need to keep investing in policy reform. Finally, I've said relatively little about monetary policy today. And that's partly because there are other forces that are more likely to be important in shaping the next chapter of the Australian economy. Monetary policy has an important role to play in supporting the economy as it goes through the current period of adjustment. It can also help stabilise the economy when it's hit by future shocks. Monetary policy can also make for a more predictable investment climate by keeping inflation low and stable as it has. And having an analytical, competent, transparent and independent central bank can also be a source of confidence in the country. But beyond these effects, monetary policy has little influence on the economy's potential growth rate. Over recent times, the Reserve Bank Board has not sought to overly fine-tune things. We've provided support and allowed time for the economy to adjust to the new circumstances. In its decisions, the Board has been careful to balance the benefit of providing this support with the risks that can come from rising household debt. As things currently stand, we look to be on course to make further progress in reducing unemployment and moving towards the midpoint of our medium-term inflation target, and that would be a good outcome. Thank you very much for listening, and I look forward to answering your questions. Thank you.
Well, Dr. Philip Lowe, thank you very much for that very important speech with such an important title, The Next Chapter, and I know you've kindly agreed to talk to me, you've kindly agreed to take questions as well from the audience, so I hope as many of you as possible will have some at the ready in a short time. Philip Lowe, I was amused that you admitted that you weren't actually going to say very much about monetary policy. Of course, that's what everybody is focused on in the markets. You said that you didn't think that monetary policy has much influence on the economy's potential growth rate.
Yeah, but ultimately, growth in the economy is driven by productivity growth and labour force participation. Yeah. Monetary policy can't do very much about either of those things. So in recent years, central banks globally have taken the mantle for supporting economies. But ultimately, growth comes from decisions made by the private sector, not from the central bank. And this is a point that I think it's kind of good for people to understand. We can do a lot to help the economies. We can support it. We can help it adjust to shocks. But the central bank can't drive medium-term growth. It's private business that can do that.
Productivity growth was something you mentioned and how important it is. How can productivity growth be cranked up? Because it is the key to your concerns about wages growth, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, the Productivity Commission currently has a review. That they're doing these reviews once every 5 years, and they're midway through the first review. But the obvious areas to be looking at, taxation policy, education policy, labour market issues, competition policy. So there's no shortage of good ideas here. The problem is getting the good ideas through the political process. So I don't want to advocate here particular policy, but these are the areas, and I know the Productivity Commission is working through these and thinking, well, what are the things that we could really do to make a difference?
You, earlier in the year, enthused about workers pushing for higher wages almost from the ground up, But afterwards followed up by saying, obviously, there's got to be productivity as well. To what extent should we, should business be looking at higher wages?
Well, I think in the medium term, what type of wage growth should we expect to see in Australia? Well, we hope to deliver you average inflation of 2.5%. And I would expect that labour productivity could grow at least 1% a year. So 2.5 plus 1 is 3.5. So if the labour share of national income isn't going to continue to fall away, then wage growth over the medium term should be able to average 3.5%. At the moment, it's kind of averaging 2. Partly that's because productivity growth is a bit lower than it normally is, but that's not the main reason, because the labour share of national income at the moment is the lowest in 50 years. So whatever productivity growth is occurring in the economy, at the moment workers are not getting their traditional share of that. And so the profit share continues to rise. So the point I made earlier in the year wasn't kind of for workers to rise up and kind of demand bigger wage increases, but it was a more general point that I think our economy and, more importantly, our society would benefit from the benefits of economic growth being more broadly shared, and that includes, over time, stronger wages growth to be something more in line with what we'd expect to see over the medium term, because the lack of wage growth is hurting household budgets, but it also means that many people feel that the benefits of growth are not being widely shared, and that's a problem economically and it's a problem socially as well.
The market has priced in, I think, 2 rate rises in the next 12 months from you. I'm wondering how much wages growth you would really want to see before you start being confident about raising rates.
Well, I don't quite see kind of a direct link between wage growth and future decisions about monetary policy. For many years, we've had an inflation targeting framework, and we make the decisions in the context of that. We wanted to deliver you 2.5% average inflation and economic stability. So that's the framework that we use when making these decisions. But the current rate of wage inflation of 2%, we will have trouble delivering 2.5% average inflation. So we'll need to see wage growth kind of pick up. This is a global phenomenon. I go to a lot of international meetings, and this is the most common question that I'm discussing with my peers, the governors of the other central banks, why wage growth is as low as it is, especially in economies with very strong labour markets and low unemployment rates. So,
I notice Governor Janet Yellen said overnight a similar sort of issue. She says what we need to figure out is whether the factors that have lowered inflation are likely to prove persistent. It would require an alteration, if they do, it would require an alteration of monetary policy. What do you think she means by that?
I suspect she's kind of reflecting on the same issues that we were just discussing. Inflation is low everywhere. If you take the unemployment rate and average in the US, Germany, Japan, the UK, the 4 biggest industrial economies, it's the lowest in many decades. So we've got kind of the opposite issue that we had in the 1970s, where we had high inflation and high unemployment. We've got very low unemployment rates and very low inflation. So it's kind of it's a good issue to have, but we've got the very low inflation rates because in many countries wage growth is very low.
So you see those two things very much linked. If you get wages growth back, you will get inflation following.
I'm sure that will happen. Inflation can be driven by other things. Commodity prices are important, and we're seeing here kind of higher electricity prices as well. But if you look right around the world, the low increases in inflation are coming about because of low wage growth. Mm. And I think she was probably reflecting on why that is. Why is wage growth so low? Because if you're at beyond full employment, you would expect wage growth to be picking up, but something's going on in country after country that means wage growth is low. And my primary explanation is that we all feel under more competition. There's more competition. We're worried about competition from the foreigners and from the robots. And when any of us are faced with more competition, we're less inclined kind of to have put our price up. I think that's Western workers feel like there's more competition out there, and so the price of labour is not going up very much. And so that's changing the inflation dynamics in many economies, and that has implications for monetary policy as well.
Philip Lowe, another area I know you're very focused on is in Australia is household debt. Now, we've recently had reports of mortgage delinquencies hitting a five-year high in May here, according to Moody's. S&P data revealing the proportion of Australians behind on mortgage payments also ticked higher. To what extent does this worry you?
It's ticked higher, but I think we've got to keep some perspective here. The loan arrears rates in Australia are still very low. They're very low globally, and they're quite low relative to our history. They've increased a little in the last year, but they're still very low. So households at the moment are coping well with the level of debt they've got. I think the issue is in an environment in which interest rates are rising or the unemployment rate is rising, that's going to be more of an issue. But as things currently stand, households don't like all the debt they've got, but they're coping okay with it.
The other matter that's come up recently is the rise of LIR loans, which were obviously a very important issue in the United States. Now, we've got a financial system here apparently sitting on $500 billion worth of LIR loans. Does that worry you that Australians are vulnerable to that should rates rise?
I don't want to kind of endorse that particular number as being accurate or not, but one of the things that we've worked very closely with APRA about is kind of the loan assessment standards that banks are using. And a couple of years ago, there was a weakening in credit assessment in financial institutions, and these loans you're talking about might have been part of that process. In the last few years, there's been quite an effort by APRA and by the financial institutions themselves to tighten up, and we've seen this in a number of dimensions. So we were worried a few years ago about the decline in credit standards. I think that's been reversed now. So there may be some kind of loans of not very good quality sitting on the balance sheet, but the systemic issue, I think, has been addressed.
And what about people's ability to afford a mortgage going forward, given all these other costs around? We saw the ACCC's Rod Sims talk very gravely yesterday about the tensions that some of the more vulnerable families have between paying their electricity bills now or paying other things like the mortgage. To what extent do you see this energy crisis impacting the Australian economy?
Well, it's having an effect on household budgets, but and particularly for some households. But overall, the cost of the standard basket of goods and services that people buy is only rising at 1.8% a year. So, you know, that's and over time, we would like it to rise more quickly than that because we want the average inflation rate to be 2.5%, not 1.8%. So the issue, I think, is not the increase in the cost of living, although that higher electricity prices does hurt some people. It's the lack of income growth. That's the thing that's unusual. The rate at which the cost of living is rising is actually quite low relative to our recent history, but the growth in income is even lower. So the higher electricity prices are kind of creating budget constraints for some households. They're making more difficult for industrial firms that have higher use of electricity to kind of compete internationally, so that's an issue. And they are also creating a more uncertain investment climate. So the generators are kind of not obviously investing, but it's also affecting investment decisions by firms that use a lot of electricity. So we see this in our liaison program.
How buoyed are you by the jobs numbers recently?
Well, it's been unambiguously positive. I mean, we've had very strong jobs growth, 2.75% over the past year. The participation rate is rising again. So people are coming back into the labour force. They're seeing opportunities there and deciding to look for jobs. And by and large, they're finding those jobs. So this is it's a positive development. Last year, we were worried that all the jobs growth was part-time and very little full-time jobs growth. And that's turned around. It's been strong growth in full-time
jobs. And what
about
you're having to look at, obviously, different states, different parts of Australia going at different speeds? We're here in the West. How do you see Western Australia's road to transition, if you like?
I see light at the end of the tunnel. I mean, it's been a very difficult few years, we know that. But we see the turnaround in a couple of the charts that I showed, that the employment is actually now rising again in Western Australia after it had been declining. The survey measures of business conditions have improved. We hear in the resources sector kind of things have improved in a number of areas. There's more sustaining investment going on, and even in exploration there's more activity going on, and that's having spin-off effects through the professional services firms. So
So to what extent, once Western Australia does pick up, can a 1.5% cash rate still be justified?
Well, that we'll make those decisions again in the context of our medium-term inflation target. So it really, really depends upon how inflation's going and kind of what growth in the economy is like. So at the moment, it's hard to see inflation being above 2.5% anytime soon at the current level of interest rates. So we'll have to keep assessing that each month as we do. And
Philip Lowe, thank you very much for talking to me.
Thank you, Tiki.
Now, can I open up, please, to the audience? Who would like to shoot a first question? One over there. So please state your name and where you're from.
Dr. Lowe, Michael Heath from Bloomberg. I just wanted to follow up on what Tiki was saying about Janet Yellen. If the economy grows well and it grows above trend, unemployment starts to come down and you're getting towards full employment or you're getting confident about that, and inflation is still stuck low. I mean, you said you weren't inflation nutters. I mean, would you be prepared to ignore that inflation if that was the case?
Well, we've been prepared to be patient. I mean, some central banks with a narrower mandate than the Reserve Bank of Australia has might have been prepared to have even lower interest rates to get inflation to come up. But the Reserve Bank's mandate, which was written in 1959, so a long time ago, is basically full employment, price stability, and the general welfare and prosperity of the Australian people. So it's a very broad mandate, and for much of the past 20 years, that type of broad mandate was unfashionable in central banking circles. But I think it's a fantastic mandate. And it's meant that we've been able to take kind of our time in getting inflation back to 2.5% because we haven't been like some other central banks whose only job is to get inflation back to their target. So in answer to your question, we're prepared to be patient. I'm confident we'll get back to 2.5% inflation. I have a 7-year term. I want inflation to average very close to 2.5% over those 7 years, and I'm confident we'll be able to do that. But we're in no rush to, you know, we don't feel kind of a need to get it back as quickly as possible. Particularly if the cost of getting it back quickly is even more borrowing and higher asset prices, which in the last year or so I felt would be the price that we would pay if we sought to get inflation back more quickly, would be more borrowing and higher asset prices, which in my view wouldn't have been in the national interest. So we've been prepared to be patient and we'll get back there, but it'll take us some time.
Right. Anyone else? Yes, ma'am.
Hi, Tess Ingram from the Australian Financial Review. Are you comfortable with the market's view with the pace of rate hikes at the moment?
Well, I think the market pricing kind of has there's two elements to it. One is that it's more likely that interest rates are going to go up than down. I would agree with that. And the second is that it's some time before an interest rate increase is likely to occur, and I would agree with that. The market pricing moves around from day to day, but those two points are right. I think more likely interest rates will go up, and it's not for some time. But people should prepare for higher interest rates. I think that's, you know, they're rising globally, and if things work out well here, over time, I'm not saying when, but over time we could expect higher rates here, and in my own view that would be a positive development for the economy.
So the only way is up, basically.
Well, I wouldn't say that. There are scenarios where I could imagine having to cut interest rates. I hope those scenarios don't eventuate, though. I think we'll all be better off. People don't like hearing this, but we'll all be better off if the next move is up rather than down.
Indeed. Another one. Yes, ma'am, in the middle.
Hello. I just wanted to ask probably a tricky question, but it's not something you hear much about. Do you have a view on some of the less traditional movements of wealth that are going on at the moment, so things like cryptocurrencies, etc., and how you see that emerging in the future and the impact on monetary policy?
I don't think it has any immediate implications for monetary policy. And most of the cryptocurrencies, as far as I can see, are really ways of people to do speculative investment. Sometimes they buy these currencies to do transactions in the black economy or the illegal economy, but more often they're people buying them to speculate on the price of the cryptocurrency. So for monetary policy, there are no direct implications. I think one of the issues we're looking at is in the future, will there be a digital Australian dollar? Because we, you know, hundreds, I don't know how many hundred years back, but people used to use clamshells for kind of as a medium of exchange. And then in the state where I live, they used rum for a while. And then we kind of used paper banknotes. And now we use polymer, and I hope you've seen our new polymer note that came out yesterday. So kind of that as technology evolves in the world, the kind of the medium that we use to exchange value changes. So it's possible that in the future people could want to exchange value through electronic tokens through their mobile devices. And those tokens could be issued by the private sector or by the public sector, by the central bank. So that's really kind of a digital form of Australian dollars. We don't have any immediate plans to do that, but it's something that we're looking at, and it's certainly possible as technology opens up new possibilities.
But you see it as more of a speculative play. I mean, that's why China has actually cracked down on
it. Yeah, it is. It's very much a speculative play, and I was just in Basel weekend before last, and it was one of the other issues we were discussing, the wage growth, but also the cryptocurrencies and the financial speculation that's taking place. And you know, China, it's a big issue. In Russia, it's an issue. In some European countries as well. My understanding is that it hasn't been that big an issue here, but it's really investor protection issue, not a monetary policy one.
Next one, down here, sir. Do state where you're from as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, Jay Leary from Freehills. Governor, thank you for your speech. I wondered what you thought were the likely growth sectors in the coming chapter and whether you'd be willing to take a stab at who will win the AFL Grand Final.
Yeah. Well, after the Sydney Swans lost, I've lost interest in
it
a
bit. That's a tragedy. Me too. And yes. Sorry about the Eagles.
The likely growth sectors, well, it's a bit of everything, isn't it? I mean, so the story for the last decade is really kind of the economy's been driven by the resources sector, so I don't think that's going to happen again. But it's really the services sectors. Now, 70% of us work in services. So it's going to be right across those industries. And it's very hard for any of us, particularly a public official, to sit here and say, well, that's going to be the growth sector and that isn't and that one is. But I really don't know. It's really up to private business to take decisions. But you can... I think the general point that I was trying to make is that whatever industries grow very strongly in the next chapter, I think the basis for that growth will have to be accumulation of human capital. You know, in the world we're living in with kind of the growth of technology and kind of global competition, if we're going to have ongoing growth in our living standards at the rates we've become used to, it must be because we can develop our human capital. And with that capital in place, whatever industries grow, we'll have the skills to do it.
Another one. Yes, Stephen Smith.
Governor, the two most encouraging words I saw in your presentation were the words India and Indonesia. Australia and Western Australia have done very well in terms of prosperity historically because we've been a great trading nation and a great trading state, but also attractive places for overseas capital investment. And historically, you've seen that with UK, US, Japan, Korea, China. But where are the next big licks of trade and investment going to come from? They must come from India and Indonesia. But at the moment, our trade and investment levels with Indonesia, despite the best efforts of governments over decades and private industry over decades, are frankly lamentable. And it's very hard to break into what will be the third biggest economy in the world in pretty short order, India. So what more do governments and private industry need to do to make sure that our prosperity doesn't decline by getting a share of the Indian and Indonesian trade and investment markets?
Well, I'm not particularly well equipped to answer that question, but I agree with the premise that in the next 20 years, growth of India and Indonesia could be very substantial. Living standards there will rise. The relative size of those economies will increase, and we have a great opportunity there to take advantage of it. I think in the last two decades, we've paid a lot of attention to China, and that's been appropriate. The development of China has been to the great advantage of Australia, but I think in the next 20 years, the development of India and Indonesia could play out very similarly to the benefits we've got from the growth in China and how business and government best takes advantage of that, I don't know. But all I know, my feeling is that it's important we find the answer to that question. People in this room better equipped to answer that than me.
Yes, sir, in the middle here, and then one over there.
Philip, thanks for coming over. Keith Barrage from Shadforth Financial Group. And thanks for reassuring me that your attitude is not socialist. It's been quite refreshing.
Yeah.
My grey hair gives me away. I do remember the last major productivity crisis in Australia came to a head in the early to mid-80s under the Hawke-Keating regime. And the most influential area that was addressed to change that was industrial relations, and that wasn't even part of your conversation. Perhaps you'd like to comment on that?
Well, we need to have an industrial relations system that encourages kind of a flexible, adaptive, innovative workforce. My sense at the moment is that that's not the kind of... If you could only do one thing, changing the industrial relations system would not be that thing. There are other issues for us to focus on. Various aspects of the taxation system, competition policy, and the way we go about accumulating human capital and kind of the incentives for innovation. That seem to be the kind of the key areas we should be working on. After all, our labour market has done pretty well. At a macro level, it's done well for the past two decades. The variation in our unemployment rate in Australia, despite the biggest mining investment boom in a century, has been quite small. Our labour market has kind of helped us ride through the various shocks. Okay, it's not to say that it's kind of working perfectly, but it broadly has worked okay. I think there are other areas really to, if you can only pick one or two to focus on.
Do we have a last couple? One over at the back and one there.
Richard Moore from Rasmax Consultants. I've just been to Sydney to the AFR Innovation Conference of the last 2 days. You've mentioned innovation a couple of times. Would you like to expand on the importance you see for innovation?
Well, I don't think I've got that much more to say other than in response to the earlier question about the growth in the future must come from doing things better and smarter, you know, across the whole range of service industries. And how do we do that? It's only if we've got an innovation mindset. Government has some role to play in creating the environment for that, but it's really down to private business and the way they operate. How we actually do it, that's not my core area of expertise. I just have a feeling that if we're going to really do well in the next 20 years, if my kids are going to enjoy a better standard of living than I, it's going to be because we've become smarter at the way we do things and we can breed innovative and adaptable companies.
Okay.
You know, for much of our history, it's been the natural resource base. The resource base we need to build on now is the one that's inside our heads.
And over here, sir.
Hi, I'm Paul Garvey from The Australian. It's a question that would have been a wild hypothetical a year or two ago, but it's sadly real now. Has the RBA put its mind towards what would happen to the economy in the event of another Korean conflict? And what sort of levers would you see the RBA having to pull in the event of a situation like that?
Well, I don't want to speculate on that because it would depend upon the nature of the conflict and how large and damaging it was. It obviously, I'm saying this, the obvious here, it would not be good. but beyond that, there's certain things that monetary policy can do and there are certain things it can't do. If there's a huge regional military conflict, there's a limit that what the Reserve Bank of Australia can do to ameliorate the effects of that on the economy. We have the kind of the standard tools at our disposal, including kind of liquidity support and interest rate policy and kind of being a source of calm reason in the economy. But if you've got a major military conflict, those things are probably second order relative to kind of other things that are going on.
Nice,
so I think we all need
there,
to kind of, yeah.
Well, Dr. Philip Lowe, it's been great. Thank you. Thank you for talking about the next chapter. Thank you for sharing those views and for taking all these questions. You've been very generous with your time. It's lovely to have you over here. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, and thanks for the opportunity to be here in Perth. Thank you.